Hi, and welcome to the Webster University in Geneva podcast. I'm Juliana Sandholm-Bark. This chapter of the podcast is an offshoot of the public lecture series called Meet the Artist, which was launched in March 2018, and during which artists are invited to talk about their work and their creative process. This is our second podcast recording of 2019 that corresponds to the second of 10 events to be held until May 2019. For more information, please visit our page through the link wcci.webster.ch/events/meet the artist. Our guest today is Lina Besonova. Hi, Lina.
Hi.
Lina is a Russian-born analog photographer and printer. Tell us a little bit about Florence. Why Florence?
Oh, it's an accident, which in retrospect does not look like an accident. An accident because when I decided to do photography, I was simply looking for an MFA degree, not an MA degree, because with an MFA you can teach at university level. And I wanted to have this kind of backup just in case, you know, I'll be looking for an actual job, not that much artistic, more, yeah, that is more regularly paid. So I wanted to invest those years in getting a terminal degree. But Florence turned out to be the only place in Europe where you can get an MFA in photography degree from an American university. That's how I ended up here. Now, the part that is not so straightforward is that my first photography professor, Francesco, who we also have here on this podcast, is Florentine. And it's extremely interesting how life develops. When I met him, I didn't think I would eventually live in Florence. When he took us for the Florence trip with large format cameras, I would never think I would end up living in the city and having my own students in that city and bringing them to the same museum where Francesco was bringing us. How many years ago? It was 2011, I think. It was 8 years ago. 8 years ago. And now I'm bringing my own students there, and it's a really crazy experience. And I think I love Florence too. It plays a part.
This is a very special episode because we have a sort of mentor and student situation here. So it's really nice to have both of you on the podcast today. Francesco, what are your memories of Lina when she was a student? So Lina's getting all scared now.
Well, it's not easy to talk about these with her in front of me, but no, I can say that she's been maybe I'm kind of talented in understanding if a student has certain kind of future in certain fields. When I met her, it was quite clear for me that she was skilled in photography and skilled as a communicator in general, and maybe a little bit presumptuous in thinking to know already everything.
True.
And what I usually do, even with my children, I don't go wall against wall, but I start trying to get around this wall from the side, you know. And I think this is what I did, and pushing probably the right buttons, I think, because Polina is quite headstrong. I think she if she doesn't want to do something, she doesn't do it, but probably she thought about what we were working on, and my goal was not to push her in analog photography, but to show him what it was. And I think she got trapped because of photography itself, not because of me, I think, because photography can present itself.
That is true, of course, because I obviously fell in love with the process. And of course, I kept doing it after our classes were over. But at the same time, what you certainly showed to me is that you can work in storytelling with photography. Like when we were going to this trips for your projects in Italy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was certainly a really great experience for me to see how professionally it can be done, how it can be translated into a book, into a bigger body of work. Mm-hmm. So it definitely changed my view of what you can do with photography. Mm. You know, because you can take pretty pictures, you can print them, but then what? And I saw that analog can be used as a valid tool of storytelling. Mm. And I should respond.
It is true that Polina was not only a student, but she also was my assistant for the two research projects I developed in Prato. And for me, having a student come with me in my personal project, it means I really trust them. So it was a...
Was I like, I was doing something important. Was I I was handling your negatives, right? I was not loading them, though. No, you don't trust anyone to load your negatives. Anyone. Not even the best assistant.
So what are your memories of Francesco as a teacher? You mentioned a few things during your lecture earlier, which were quite, you know, funny, but also moving. You know, you said, so tell us a little bit again in the podcast, if you could.
Well, the part that I told in the lecture was that, Francesco maybe tried going around my stubborn wall, right? But at the same time, he was trying to do it with a bit of indifference. I guess because his assumption was that if he pushes me too much, I might not do it, actually. Which is a correct assumption. I will say...
He's a good reader of people.
Yeah, certainly. And I saw how Francesco communicates differently with different students. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that made me so mad because I saw how nice and soft he could be with some people. And with me, it was nice. I'm talking about the first courses. With me, it was nothing like sore or nothing like close to being soft and nice. Mm-hmm. And it was always like either indifference or criticism. But then it was in the right proportions. And at the same time, I loved photography so much I couldn't stop doing it. And I somehow hoped that this criticism was exactly to push me to be better. And I wasn't wrong. And it worked. You know, I did eventually grow a lot here in Webster. And afterwards, I finally realized that photography is my one big love. So Francesco opened me this world and showed everything from smaller film cameras, medium format cameras, to large format, which was complete love, and which inspired me to do the documentary project. It was all thanks to Francesco. I didn't even think those cameras exist. Like, where would I know? Like, how would I know about it? You know, okay, Ansel Adams pictures, but you look at them and think those cameras aren't produced anymore, they're hard to get, whatever, let it go. But then when you see an actual person working with those actual cameras, you think, huh, you know, I can do it too. Mm-hmm. So it's very important seeing a person not just as a professor who just talks to you, but also who does things in his life. And right now, Francesco is doing a PhD. And we were talking about it. He told me, you should do a PhD too. I didn't have time for now, but I'm thinking about it all the time.
I think it's going to be the natural development.
Probably
in like 10 years. Yeah? We'll talk about this in 10 years.
Yeah? Yeah. We'll do another podcast in 10 years.
Looking forward to that one. You compared a little bit your Webster Geneva experience where you got a BA in media communication and marketing, right, you said?
Marketing and photography. I had certificates in marketing.
Marketing and photography. And you received your MFA in photography in Florence.
Yeah.
So how would you compare these experiences, these educational experiences in the two places? You said you were opened up to new possibilities at Webster. And then in Florence, like, just curious about what you learned as a student in Florence. You know, did you have a good mentorship in Florence that matched Francesco's mentorship abilities? Or, you know, what was it like and how would you compare the experiences?
It was completely different. First of all, because when I started the website, I didn't know what I wanted. I mean, I thought I wanted radio, which never happened. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, I was more all over the place, open to everything. Actually, I loved marketing, too. I have better grades in marketing than in photography, by the way. Although I did get my department honors. I was like, I need to get the department honors. Mm-hmm. It was just for fun. Mm-hmm. But there, when I went for my MFA, I knew very precisely. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So also, I was looking for an MFA which would give me the possibility to work in the darkroom as much as possible. It was like super important requirement. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to find a program with two amazing co-directors. They're great people, extremely knowledgeable. And one of them worked, I don't remember how many years, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe more, at Fratelli Alinari. It's the oldest, world's oldest photography archive. He worked there as a printer. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine his level of experience, right? Mm-hmm. And he owned his own lab in mm-hmm. Florence. He is mm-hmm. Italian. So it was the person I wanted to learn from. But it was more like learning the practical part. You know, mm-hmm. I just wanted to work on my skills, nothing else. I didn't care about anything else. And here in Webster, I was more focusing on getting a lot of skills, even accounting. Accounting mm-hmm. helped me in life, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And writing, like journalism and psychology, actually, mm-hmm. and web design. You know, all
so
of the
broader set of skills.
Of course, mm-hmm. here I just try getting all those set of skills. While in my MFA, I was more already applying them. Mm-hmm. I was more applying them in making the website, in writing about my work, in branding my work, in all of that, while working on the skills. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely different, just you can't compare those two, really. Mm-hmm. And the second co-director of the program, I should totally mention him because he'll be listening to this podcast. he did a great job at the history of photography. Like, his classes were just hypnotizing. I remember them. And when I was afterwards in certain situations where people would ask me about photography, he was able to talk so well about the context of photography, of the development of the contemporary art and how it interconnects with past photographers and all of that, so that I was able to have discussions with people who already know the art field. Mm. And I felt so good, you know, I felt really confident about that. So it's really important to know your theory and to have your skills.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you spoke earlier in the lecture about the importance of post-production a little bit, right? The printing process.
Oh,
That's super important. But then you also talked about, you know, okay, now that I have these skills, now what? The content, the subject.
Yeah.
So how did your relationship to these two ends of what photography is about develop, and where are you at now?
I think they go like walking, like you put one foot forward, you put the next foot forward, and then the other one. So I just focus a little bit more on the skill part, not a little bit, I just go all in the skill part, and I don't care what I'm printing as long as it's a difficult enough negative that I have to work on a lot and figure out how to do it. That's when I'm advancing my skills. But then when a project comes up, like I'm having a show soon, and I need to produce stuff, I don't have time to experiment, I don't have time to work on my skills, that's when the art part comes in. So I have to rely on what I learned before in order to advance the artistic part. And then I'm so looking forward to getting over with this show and then finally experimenting with some techniques that I read about in a book a week ago. And yeah, I can't wait. That's it. But I can't experiment right now because I need to have a predictable outcome. You know, afterwards, this art world is not all about experiments, pure experiments and pure, I don't know, just pure unpredictability. Sometimes you have to be predictable.
Mm. So this, you're talking about the commissioned work on construction projects?
This is one.
Okay.
And then the second one, I'll have just a show of my personal work in New York at the gallery of the school where I graduated from with MFA. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's more personal work.
Yeah, yeah. And I was so glad they offered this to me. Oh, you have Jung over there. He influenced me so much.
There's a Jung poster on the wall.
There's a book.
There should be a poster because it's a...
He's one of my greatest influences.
In the counseling room. So.
Actually, thanks to Webster. And yeah, because I took a Jung in psychology class, which absolutely blew my mind. And I read all the books by Jung afterwards. Yes. And I can say that his influence is like super fundamental. Again, thanks, mm-hmm. Webster.
Mm-hmm. you had a show in Florence.
Yeah.
At a gallery. yeah. called Tetis Gallery.
Tetis Gallery,
Tetis
yeah.
Tetis Gallery. So was this a show?
It's a part of the MFA.
It's
yeah,
part
it,
of the MFA.
It was a group show. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So that's on your website.
Yeah.
So I was trying to see what kinds of shows you had. And I was looking for the biography on your website to get a sense of that. Do you like showing your work in public?
I don't know. I really don't. I hate talking about my work. I know it's necessary. I know it's necessary. But I just don't like showing off in a way too much. And it makes me feel so intimidated when people come to me like, oh, your work is so amazing. Mm. I just want to hide and disappear somewhere. It's crazy. But at the same time, I know that if I show my work, it inspires others. Mm. And that's the only reason that just pushes me to overcome it and to be like, okay, because people look at my work and they're like, oh, maybe I can do the same. You know, maybe I have a future in analog.
It's a matter of contamination, you know.
Yeah. You have to make other people excited about it.
Yeah. Well, I have a question about, because you're in France right now, right?
Yes.
So, but you are an international, you were an international student, you are an international person, we can say that, right? So my question is, how do you interact with the Florentine cultural world, and how much you feel you need to get out of it, and if there's a way to get out of it?
If there is a way, because Florence always stays with you, right? Wherever you go.
Well, don't answer in the way you think I would answer, because I live here now, so there must be a reason
there
as
must
well.
Be.
But my question is about the cultural context in Florence, which I have my own idea, but of course I would like to hear from you.
I will start with one of the main reasons why I decided to stay. Okay, yes, I did have a lab there, and life is cheap. Much cheaper than in Geneva, and I wouldn't be able to have a lab in Geneva, you know, never. So this is one very practical aspect which kept me there. But, you know, I could choose from anywhere in Italy, right? Or I could go to Spain, the language is a bit similar, you know. But what really struck me about Florence, actually, even the first time we went there, but maybe I didn't interact with people as much, but the following times we went there for Francesco's projects, and afterwards when I started my degree, is how amazing Florentine people are. They're completely different from the rest of Italy, really. I traveled a lot through Italy, and I've met great people.
Do you agree, Francesco?
Can't say too much. Especially because yesterday we won 7-1 against Roma in a football match. So, you know,
I wouldn't be able to live in Rome.
Sorry.
No, it's a wonderful city to visit. It's rich in history, and maybe actually it's more dynamic, which kind of is better for me because I'm from Moscow, and Moscow is a huge dynamic city. So it's a great shift towards Florence for me, for example. But I grew up in Geneva, so, you know.
But let me refocus the question
on Florence.
I am talking about the cultural context.
The cultural context.
So the cultural life of Florence. You know what I mean?
Yes. Also, what I love about Florence is how people don't judge you at all. I mean, they do judge you, but in a different way. They don't look at your clothes. They don't look at your makeup. They don't look at your car. None of this matters at all. It's absolutely true. It's remarkable. You can wear head to toe, I don't know, Louis Vuitton, Dior. No one will even care because people look at who you are. In Milan, it's not like that at all. But it's a different city with different good sides of it too. So Florence is much less dynamic, but at the same time, I think that Florence is in general content with itself because it has such a rich history. It doesn't need to prove anything, you know? When you're already rich, you don't have to prove anyone anything. When you're already successful, you just chill there and accept all those tourists that give you money, you know? And that is also a bit, I think, the mentality of the people that are like, I'm Florentine, I have nothing to prove to anyone. I'm from such a city, you know, that it's already by default above everyone because we were the cradle of Renaissance. That's it. So I love it. I absolutely love it. I love the people, how chill they are, how nice they are. You smile at people and they do anything for you. But the bad part, you cannot motivate people with money at all. It's impossible. And that was my biggest issue when doing my lab. Because you say, look, I will pay double. I will pay double. Mm-hmm. If you do it twice as fast, or at least like 3 days before, no. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to go to the sea on the weekend with my family. I have to take my siesta, and then I have a festa, and then I have an aperitivo. What, do you want me to work extra hours? I'm sorry, but I'm paying you. No.
Wow. Yep. Good life-work balance.
They have an extremely good work life-work balance, and that's something I also learned. Because I came there and I was all agitated, and I was like, oh, I need to do things fast. Mm. You know, I need to work on things. And everyone was so chill and happy. And I'm still learning that from Florentine.
Sounds like LA, the way you describe it.
What, Florence?
Los Angeles, yeah. Everybody's chill.
Really?
No stress. Yeah, if you compare going from like New York to LA.
Yeah?
That's the impression you have, the same exact.
Wow. Yeah. I've always had this stupid idea that I wanted to live in LA, at least for a little bit. I don't know why. It's been there for years, actually. So maybe I should follow this.
Do you have another question. So, it's about Paulina, actually. How is your photographer's, artist, photographer's life in the Florentine context and the Italian context? How much interaction with the others? I mean, starting from the local.
Yeah.
To the national contest, national, I would say Italian, and then abroad. I mean, like, for instance, I guess your students are mainly international. So.
Yes. So, surprisingly so, the most amount of people who know about me are from the US or from Italy. I guess Italy because I'm almost local now. And the US because probably my Instagram is in English and my YouTube videos are in English. So, and in America, a lot of people have basements where they can make dark rooms. It's a luxury we can't have in Europe. And that's a huge factor. That's a huge factor. In Italy, there is a very big film community, surprisingly, which I discovered. They found me through Instagram, of course. And I met those absolutely great guys. They are from Rovigo region, the Branco Ozzico team, and they are just experimenting with chemistry, with different processes. They run workshops, they do events. And how I met them, they were organizing a photo festival, and they just wrote to me on Facebook and said, hey, do you want to exhibit your work? And I said, yeah, sure. And afterwards, they told me that they invited me simply because I had a lot of followers. And they didn't think my work would be that good because, you know, what you see on Instagram is not what you see in real life, right? You can always embellish your prints. Then in real life, you bring something like ugly and flat, which looked so nice online. So they didn't expect much from me, but they just wanted to use my name, which was already shocking to me. Like, who wants to use my name? Are you serious? I'm like, I'm just a simple person. And suddenly all of that. So when I brought my work and they saw my work, that's when they started respecting me. They're like, oh, okay, you know, this girl can print. Okay. Mm-hmm. And through this festival, I met other photographers who kind of knew about me again. I have no clue how. But they came to this festival and saw my work. And again, you know, it was apparently good quality. At least I'm not ashamed of it. So probably impressed them. Again, those are guys who are like 60 plus, you know, who have been working in the darkrooms for 15, 20 years. So it meant a lot to me that they approved of my work. And I kind of became friends with them as well. So they're from all over Italy. And then again, Italy is all about talking. It's all about sharing. It's all about word of mouth. So once you know one single person in this country, you know half the country. But that can play against you, you know, if you are doing bad work, if you're not a nice person, if you offend someone, that's it, you're done.
Yeah.
So far, I think, knock on wood, I've been doing good, but I'm just trying my best.
And let's talk about these students of yours who come from the US and
Europe,
And Europe. How, so they find you on Instagram and Actually, thinking of Instagram, did you sort of analyze your, you know, these sophisticated Qualtrics is something else, isn't it?
Yeah.
But these analytics, you know, these data analytics where you can see, okay, I got most hits after this happened. Did you sort of look at mm-hmm. your activity and you did something and then that got you a lot of likes right after or a lot of followers? How did you acquire so many followers? Because remind us how many followers you have and how that actually happened over time.
I have like 15,000, 15 and a half. It's going there. I need 30 more to get 15 and a half.
Yeah,
I'm waiting.
So how did that happen?
A lot of people came from my YouTube videos, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I did some videos. Again, I did them just for entertainment, just to share what I like. And a lot of people went from YouTube to Instagram because YouTube is very well indexed by Google.
Mm-hmm.
And when they would be looking for large format photography, and one of the videos, I have like 75,000 views on it. It's the simplest video in the world. I'm like, hey guys, this is my new camera and I'm going to take a picture with it. And I take a picture. Boom! Nothing else. I'm serious. But then my mommy filmed it. My mommy is like behind a lot of stuff. She does the backstage. She helps me a lot. So she just filmed, again, it was just for entertainment. But then when people would Google 4x5 photography, they would find my video because there aren't many videos like this. And I did it 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, there were like even less than now. Mm. So it just probably I entered the right narrow market at a very right time.
Mm-hmm.
That's seriously all I can say. Mm-hmm. That's the probably only secret. Then, of course, right now, I didn't have a business account back then. They didn't exist even back then. Now I do have a business account. I do look into my analytics, but then it's easy to get obsessed and it's mm-hmm. easy to lower the quality of your content.
Right.
And I'll explain how. Because, for instance, if we look at my analytics, the biggest amount of likes are those photos where I'm in it, you know,
mm-hmm.
where I'm like looking all nice and like holding this print
right.
and stuff. Oh, yeah, of course, they get a lot of likes and stuff. But if I start posting a lot of those, this would devalue the overall content of the Instagram. I can't put myself forward too much. I already feel like I'm doing it a little bit too much, to be honest.
Mm.
I feel like I really need to refocus on my work and what I do, you know, to step back a little bit, because being in the spotlight is all cool, but then again, it devalues your work because you're seen as just a persona,
mm-hmm.
you know, not as a anyhow professional.
Mm-hmm.
So next year, I'm thinking to really cut down the amount of workshops and just focus on my work only.
Mm-hmm.
That is hopefully financially sustainable plan. We'll see.
And what would you do if somebody just even sponsored you for, like, let's say you got a grant. Let's imagine you just got a grant from someone. You can just do whatever you want. What would you do if somebody just gave you a grant tomorrow mm-hmm. to develop a personal project? What would you do?
No, I would still finish the construction project because I absolutely love it.
Okay, but that's a commission work.
Okay.
But let's say that's over. And then what would you do?
I would probably spend at least half a year, again, just working on the printing part, not developing the content, because I keep discovering new things that can be done with analog photography. Each day I'm reading like something new in the book and I'm like all pumped and excited and I want to just put it to practice, but I can't because I need to print other stuff. So
I see.
Yeah, I would.
So you would take old negatives and play with them, or?
Yeah, I would take some kind of difficult negatives, you know, because mm-hmm. only when you print difficult stuff, that's when you learn.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would certainly experiment with those double toning and bleaching, and I would like to do more scientific work. Oh, I know what I want to do. I want to write a book. I want to write a book for beginners in analog photography. That's not even a dream. That's like a plan, which I hopefully will do next year if I really cut down on workshops.
Then we can use it in our courses.
You can absolutely use it. Yes, I want to do a really good product because there are good books about analog, but they are old. Like they were written, not centuries. Oh, yes, last century, you know, the past century. And now we only see the re-editions. And they are amazing. They're great, but they're written in an old language, you know? Nowadays, young people, they perceive differently. Mm-hmm. Like we were talking during lunch, I said, any video that is longer than 10 minutes, no one will watch it unless it's some very, very special information and this person is really committed to watching. Otherwise, no one will watch it. Mm-hmm. The attention span is extremely short. You have to be more visual. You have to be more straight to the point. You don't have to have all this fluff. You know, the people of the old times, they would just go round and around some topic and talk about, I don't know, their childhood and then about some concepts. And then they only get to the technique, mm-hmm. which takes like 2 pages. Mm-hmm. I would really love to do something that is practical, but at the same time, very professional and very well researched and good quality, you know?
Mm-hmm. So what does a book have that a YouTube video wouldn't? Because you could produce a series of tutorials and think of your book as in a YouTube format. So what would a book do differently?
Analog people like having everything physical.
Like a tangible thing you can hold.
Yes, that's absolutely.
Still has value.
You are asking the very right question because I certainly don't want to give up my YouTube. I want to do more videos, which I unfortunately don't have that much time doing. You know, I'm posting like one video in 3-4 months. I have a lot to explain and discuss, but it's just hard also filming on your own and editing. Editing can take 2 days. I'm not that amazing at it. And I don't like being in front of the computer, so every time it demotivates me. Every time I have a option of I should post something on Instagram or I should do a YouTube video, I just go to the darkroom. So that's it. That's just how it ends,
it's
right there.
It's a difficult choice.
So I would certainly want to do a series of YouTube videos. And the book would, yes, it would talk about the same, but look, the way you perceive things when you watch them and when you listen to them is different than when you read them. Mm-hmm. So it would just go parallel to that. Mm-hmm. It would be maybe more structured, maybe it's like a handout material at a workshop. Mm-hmm. You know, you do explain things, you do show things, but then people have something like refer point of, how do you call it?
A reference book.
Reference book, exactly.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hmm.
So do you think of yourself as an artist?
At the end of my MFA program, we had to write a thesis, which would explain our work and what we learned and all this stuff. 25 pages. I used all the 25 pages. I wrote everything, not using a single time the word art or artist, because I'm allergic to this word. Mm. Not because of what it means, but you know, it's such a word like let's say love, you know?
It's a charged word.
Yes, and overused and abused and devalued.
Absolutely.
Like, look at St. Valentine's, which is coming soon. It doesn't have anything to do with actual
love. Are you
talking
about art or are you talking about love?
Oh, no. those are extremely similar things, mm-hmm. you know? Art can also be something, be a label that can be put on something that is extremely far away from art. And it's something that cannot be defined. And that's why this label can be put on anything. And also, I do not believe I am the one to put this label on myself. Mm-hmm. So if you're asking me who I am, I would rather prefer to be referred as a printer. Mm-hmm. Because that's what I truly love. And I love doing this. And that's like an actual job, you know? Mm-hmm.
Then the question is, would you love to print someone else's work? As a printer.
If I had 48 hours in the day, yes, because it is entertaining for me to play with other people's negatives, certainly, because I learn a lot as well. So it's just for the technical part of it, for my own learning. But I love printing my work. I love printing it so much.
Because, you know, when I was printing in my pre-PhD life,
yes.
which I hope will come back soon after the PhD.
Uh-huh.
One thing is when you are printing your own work and you're developing your own photographs.
Uh-huh.
Another thing is when you are doing what, for instance, Foto Morgana or labs are doing in Florence or in other places I know, they earn their life printing the other people's work. They spend 10 hours a day or 8 hours a day, I don't know how much, printing everyone else's work but yours, which is something that I could not see myself doing because it's So you are a printer.
Mm-hmm.
And there are printers like Cartier-Bresson printers, for instance. Cartier-Bresson didn't use to print his own work.
No, he didn't.
He had a printer.
No.
They love doing that. Maybe they love printing Cartier-Bresson's work, but some other cases you have other people, they come and they print something that you don't particularly love, but you have to do it because it's work.
Then you're absolutely correct. That's a good point. Then I would redefine myself as, let's say, I don't want to say like teacher, but I would like to add some educational part in it. Mm. So I like printing, but I also love, absolutely love teaching other people do it. Mm-hmm. It's when my students print their work successfully and they're happy about the print, oh, I'm twice as happy. I like literally jump around the dark and I'm like, oh, you did so great. They're looking at me like, why is she so excited about this print? And when you print, the thing is that your mindset is completely different when you print for others, because when you print for others, you have to understand what this person is thinking, what this person is feeling. So first, it's a whole psychology work, because I can see the print one way, the person, you know that negative is just a matrix.
Mm.
You can interpret it in a billion different ways with the paper choice, with the contrast choice, with the toning, with bleaching, with all kinds of stuff. So I can't know how this person sees this negative. So first you have to, and a lot of people say, oh, I don't know, I just need to print.
Mm.
You're like, okay, look. So I usually ask to refer to some other photographers whose work they like. For instance, some people like Sebastiano Salgado's style. I don't like it. It's too HD for me, honestly. But can you print like this? Yeah, of course. I wouldn't do it by choice, but if someone comes and says, look, I want this really powerful, overwhelming, dark feel, who am I to say no, right?
Then again, Salgado, I don't think he prints his own work. So he has
a
printer.
I think his work is digitally printed also.
Well, his work is not digitally printed. I mean, he takes now
the
digital
latest
images, and then they are transformed into negatives.
Uh-huh.
And then they are printed. So they are on Silver Gelatin print. But you know why? Because he had a market with art galleries, and art galleries are still asking him to produce Silver Gelatin prints because they sell. But of course then his style comes because he speaks with printers. So clearly there is his input in the way. You're right. I mean, his work is pretty dramatic.
It is dramatic.
Because probably his input to get that. That way.
Well, it's his style. Look, the thing is that when you want to define the style, you think immediately of him, which is great.
Well, what I saw in your work in the book you printed and
I gave you
prints,
this book.
Yes, I have it home and it's signed. I think your prints are more subtle and soft tones, and even though you have your blacks and you have your whites, but how can I say? The level of dramatic tones is lower than, of course, in other people's work, which is a style. So would you want to say something about that? Or
I have two things to say about that. First is a lot of people don't even know you can print like that. It's surprising, but it's true. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just get a more or less right contrast that seems right, and they get a adequate exposure, they got their highlights, their shadows, everything is fine. They print it and they think this print is good. They don't think that you can go anywhere further from that. And a lot of visual imagery like that we're surrounded by right now is dramatic. Like, again, referring to the Instagram or advertising or TV, what you see, everything is charged and dramatic. So it's natural inclination to do everything more, a little bit more contrasty, a bit more HD, you know, a little bit sharper, more aggressive, so that it jumps at you. It is normal for, I think, our generation and our culture. It's a normal reaction. So a lot of people don't even think that you can communicate just as much by doing subtler prints. It just doesn't come to their mind. And some workshop participants told me, like, wow, I never thought printing lighter my image would look so great.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't occur, and it's no one's fault. I discovered it by accident. Of course, I knew about those high key prints. It's not something new, but then, to be honest, I've never seen them in real life. No, I don't think I have. That's interesting. But anyway, I was printing normal. I was printing like a normal person. So good range of tones, everything technically correct, blah, blah, blah. And then came a mistake. Yeah. It was one of those rare days when I was not alone in the darkroom and another girl was printing. So she was processing her image and I was processing mine. And accidentally our images got stuck together. Or hers was moving and mine underneath wasn't. So something like this happened. So my print was very underprocessed, extremely underprocessed. So when I turned on the light, it was maybe 3 stops lighter than I originally intended. And I saw it, I was like, mamma mia, I think I have to reprint all of my work. That's just how it happened. Mm. I was like, it's light, but it's remarkably beautiful. It's completely different from what I printed before. And that's how I discovered. Second discovery came when I accidentally left one of my very light prints now in the selenium toner for longer. What selenium toner does, it first acts on your shadows, making them theoretically darker. In reality, not that super much, but still, it makes darker and gives them a slightly colder tone. Okay, and it's used for archival purposes, so that, yeah, the print stays alive longer. I was doing it for archival purposes. I was just told that it's good, and I was doing it. And then I left it in the selenium longer. Maybe I just had a text or a call or something. So when I came back, my print was purple. And I loved it. I loved it so much. Maybe this one was too purple, okay? But I loved how this very light tone with this slight light purple tint worked together. I was like, this is freaking magic. And I had to retone all of my prints. Thankfully, you can retone afterwards. So, And now... I discovered sepia and selenium toning, and this is mind-blowing. It's beautiful and takes so much time. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because one print can take up to 5 hours of work.
Wow.
Yeah. If you start from zero,
It's really cool hearing you talk about developing work. It almost seems like you have transformational moments in the darkroom where realize or... You know, you're transformed by the process itself. It's very magical. Do you think others are inspired by seeing your work and reacting to its beauty when you talk about the beauty of, you know, these printing processes? Do you see people sort of being transformed by viewing your work?
Oh.
Do you think there's that kind of thing going on?
I don't know. I'm terrified to think what people think of my work, to be honest.
I mean, it sounds like you're very moved and so emotionally drawn into the process and so overwhelmed with excitement at the result. Yeah. And I was just wondering if that magic can ever be passed on to the viewers who look at your work.
We have to get the viewers here.
That you've witnessed. But you've never... Because you show your work, so I was just wondering if you witness this sort of reaction. Like, just... something, you know, the person just being overwhelmed by what they see.
I hope I reach that level when someone faints in front of my work, but so far I haven't. And another thing, like, you know, I recently had to write an article. It was the first time for me to write an article for publication. So I was like, I was afraid. I was terrified. I sat down, although it was about photography, so about something I really love. If it was an article about anything else, I wouldn't care, but it was about photography. So I read like 4 books before that so that I don't repeat those other books. Sat down, I wrote it in 2 hours maybe, and I never read it again. And when I sent it to the editor, he was like, oh, okay, cool, like, thank you. And then silence. I was like, okay, I hope it was decent, I hope it was okay. In the end, turned out that he actually just forgot about it. He forgot that I sent it to him. And he asked me to send it again. It was fine. Like, I had my page and everything. He was just thinking I forgot about it. Mm-hmm. And I sent him again. And then him and his girlfriend, who is also helping him with editing and partially with the magazine, both called me and are like, it's so amazing. It's so beautiful. This is the kind of journalism we want to see in our publication. I'm still afraid to read this article. I haven't read it again. So I think that's about all the work that I care about. I'm just afraid to look at my old prints. It's just terrifying to me. And showing my work, I just put it on the wall, and I prefer leaving somewhere. So unless someone catches me and just drags me and asks questions, I want to stay away. Mm-hmm. During the photo festival where I met a lot of photographers, actually, it was 3 days. So on Friday I was there, and it was so overwhelming. Like, so many people came to me and wanted to talk to me that Saturday I just didn't go. Even though people were saying positive things, it just terrified me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's weird, and probably it will pass in a bit. I don't know.
You can just interact on Instagram in the meantime.
Yeah, on Instagram. See, on Instagram, you don't see the real people, and it's completely different. Mm-hmm. On Instagram, I'm detached. I'm in my own little world, and I'm safe. Mm-hmm. You know, when it's real people who have real emotions, and if people have emotions from my work, I partially don't believe it, in a way. And I don't think I should believe it. I think it's okay like that. Let it be a mystery for me.
Mm. But do you want to share this sort of sensations that you feel, you know, that you were describing so well? Like this kind of euphoria. I mean, it's like, oh, look at how beautiful, you know, this purplish print is. You know, do you want to share that and have people enjoy that kind of feeling?
But that's what I'm doing, but I'm sharing it about the process, you know? So it's not specific to my work. It can happen to anyone's work, right? Mm-hmm. I can take anyone's print, anyone's negative, mm-hmm. and print it in a different way and tone it in some experimental way, or just choose some interesting paper or mm-hmm. frame it differently, whatever. Like, we can do a lot of fun stuff with it and show how beautiful it is. And to me, it's a discovery as well, you know? To me, it's excitement about the process, it's about the magic that is happening. It's something that I'm not controlling, or I was supposed to control. I didn't control it. It came out so beautiful. It's just crazy. The print is just the final product, in a way. It's what the process is.
Your question about whether it's the same thing to develop your own work or somebody else's, which is Francesco's question.
I would never let anyone print my negatives, ever. So I don't know how photographers trust anyone to print, but I can understand in which cases it is possible, and it's actually good. If the work is documentary, let's say, so the content matters more than the printing process. So yes, that fact that it's done analog matters and everything, but you know, those some subtleties that you would put in the print and maybe the printer doesn't, they don't affect the overall message. Like, the message is more important than mm-hmm. the medium. Mm-hmm. In my case, medium is at least equally as important.
Mm-hmm. So that's the difference between an artist and a photographer, right there.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I don't think art can be defined by anything, you know. Yeah, art can
be... That's one of the components, isn't it? That when message is more important... That seems to be the line of separation between, you know, what art is really about. It has to be more than about the content. It has to be more than about the subject matter and about the message. It goes beyond.
You know, I don't necessarily maybe agree, because look, a lot of contemporary art is just about the message and nothing else. You know, it can be a found object.
But then it's a question whether it is art.
Well, certainly the fact of doing things, right? It's craft. It's not necessarily art. There is a point when craft becomes art. But there is, I think that art does have to have craft and message, or at least some kind of attempt at craft, and the message. But those things separately are just a message, which means pure documentary. I mean, none of that work. Mm-hmm. But again, documentary, what is it? Like recording from
a web. We should have to ask Jennifer this question. She would have a lot to say. No, Jennifer is another photographer who was on the show. Yeah.
So you just put a webcam and record from it. That's a documentary, you know. But then you take some stills from this webcam and print them huge and put them on the wall, and boom, suddenly it started. That's what people do. So where is craft? Craft is a little lost, but then it's art. It's in the museums. It's in the art shows.
It's so, in my opinion, so subjective. Eventually, there are too many people involved. Is the artist in person, then the person using the art and looking at it, and I think it's very complicated. That's why I don't like to call myself an artist, or
yeah,
because it's too complicated. And to me, it's like digging in an ocean and getting lost somehow. Mm. And because there are very too many elements involved. It's like, you know, I found this phone in an abandoned factory in Prato, and it was burnt because it was a fire.
In this fire, yeah.
And this phone is from like 1970s phone, and the phone it's melted. Like a Dalí.
Beautiful.
And it's an object I've just found. And if you stick it on a wall in a gallery, I can tell you that, in my opinion, it would sell.
Of course, because it's art. It tells a story.
It depends on the gallery and the connections they have.
It depends on the artist, and it depends on the gallery.
And it depends on the message of the object itself.
It's the message.
I would pay to get it. And in fact, it's in my apartment.
Yeah.
Because I found it. But if you put it in an art gallery and say someone did it on purpose, melting it on purpose, and it has a message of communication today, which is fluid, and you add some meaning inside.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You put it in a red frame, you know.
Brainstorming.
Yeah, for the sake of argument.
Yeah.
Yeah, but absolutely, people have an issue with the word art and artist and what it means, and of course, and it's interesting. I had Nina Rodin on the podcast a while ago, and she was explaining she went to art school, and it took her quite a while to wrap her head around this word artist and to use it about herself. It took a very long time to get the comfort level to where she was able to say, I'm an artist now. So it was like a whole coming of age process where came the day where she felt confident enough to say, because you have to sort of grow into the role. And it's a very difficult process, which is why I always ask this question to everybody who I'm going to ask you this question.
It took
too.
Me okay. a really while to call myself a photographer, and don't think I'm still comfortable with that.
But that's also a charged term.
Yeah.
Because it comes with all the history of what that represents.
Mm. Or like, I can have an iPhone and be a photographer.
Mm-hmm. And an artist.
And an artist, certainly.
And we were just talking
and
about
I
that,
know,
right?
And I know, amazing.
Either you
sorry,
go
yeah.
the democratic way, or you go the institutional way and the sort of closed...
Yeah. I know amazing people who do great work with an iPhone. Mm. And I even follow them on Instagram, because it's beautiful. You know, I don't care what they did it with. It's gorgeous. The moments they catch are beautiful. Mm. Like, I don't care what they did it with. Mine is more about the process. So I think, bottom line is with the art, is that calling yourself an artist is like calling yourself a good person. No one will trust you until you prove it. So, and actually they will be suspicious of you if you say I'm a good person. They will think you have something to hide. So if someone else calls you an artist, you should gracefully accept it. Mm. But running around and calling yourself an artist, I think it's maybe a bit too much. Maybe for me now.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lina, so much. And thank you. It is a great conclusion. Thanks, Francesco, for being here also.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And
thank
all the
you
best
guys.
To you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me here. And thank you, Francesco and Giuliano, for making it happen. I'm super excited to be here, really. And thank you, Webster.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.